So good morning, Professor Newman and Professor Stein. Thank you very much for joining us and for agreeing to this interview. The main topic of this discussion series is the history of spin glasses and replica symmetry breaking, which we roughly bound from 1975 to 1995. And both of you have contributed to that in that context and these epoch. But before we get to that, I have a few questions on background which help us situate a bit both of your works on this. And we'll start with you, Professor Newman. So in a variety of interviews, you've explained how you got to pursue a math degree, but how did you first get interested in physics? Can you tell us a bit about what brought you to this field?
Well, I guess you may already know some of this. Almost all of my degrees are actually in physics. I started out as a physics undergraduate at MIT a long time ago. I originally didn't plan to do anything particularly in mathematics, but I had such a wonderful kind of a special introductory rigorous course in calculus when I was a freshman, which was fairly unusual. I think not so unusual maybe in France or Italy, but definitely unusual in the U.S. That got me interested in mathematics also. And by the time I finished MIT, I ended up with 2 degrees and an extra degree in mathematics. And even though I was a graduate student in physics at Princeton, as was Dan some years later, I focused on mathematical physics. So in a way, I don't have to explain how I got involved in physics. I was in physics first and then got involved in mathematics.
But if we step back a bit, why did you choose physics? What drew you initially to physics?
Okay. So, part of it was a misunderstanding of the term. I had an uncle, actually a quite distinguished, not uncle by marriage, Marvin Camrus. He was passed away years ago, married to my mother's sister, who was really an electrical engineer, but he worked eventually at Illinois Institute of Technology, in their sort of research part. And he had a title. His title was senior physicist, which I remember hearing this title when I was a child. And I said, oh, well, he seems a very smart guy and he's a physicist. But he actually wasn't a physicist. He was really an electrical engineer. I said, OK, I guess I'll go into physics also. It seems like a nice area. I didn't know what physics was at the time. Of course, I learned what physics was as a physics major at MIT, but my original inclination was actually based on this misunderstanding of what my uncle's profession was.
Professor Stein, can you tell us what first got you interested in physics and what led you to pursue graduate studies in theoretical physics after that?
Yes. I've been interested in science in general and physics in particular since I was very young. I don't know where that arose from. I mean, I'm probably like Chuck, I don't come from an academic background or, you know, nobody in my family was, in science or in any kind of academic endeavor. But I seem to have a special interest in it and was drawn to it, especially astronomy when I was a kid, not that I lived in a place where you could see the stars very well, but what you could see, I found somehow spoke to something deep inside of me, I guess. And I loved math and science in school. But by the time I got to college, I was interested in I went to Brown University as an undergraduate. I was interested in a very wide variety of things. I was even contemplating being an English major until I realized that evaluation of my writing abilities probably wouldn't translate to the outside world. And so I finally gave in to my inner voice, my inner impulses telling me that this is really what I wanted to do, and I've been sort of avoiding it the whole time. So in my sophomore year, I finally decided I was going to become a physics major. So I came in sort of late in the second semester of my sophomore year. And I loved it from the very beginning. I also loved mathematics. I had some wonderful mathematics professors, a similar story to Chuck's in that sense. And like Chuck, when I graduated, I got bachelor's degrees in both math and physics, a double major. And then I went to Princeton to get a PhD in physics. And so that's sort of my background story.
But so what drew you to Princeton and to work with Phil Anderson in particular?
Right. Well, when I first applied to Princeton, I applied to a number of schools I did well in terms of the application process. And initially, I had thought I was going to go to Harvard, and I'm not sure whether I should continue with this, but I will anyway. I would have ended up going to Harvard, except I graduated early from Brown after 3.5 years, and I was working at the Naval Research Laboratory on plasma physics problems down in Anacostia in Washington, D.C. I decided to drive up to Harvard, and I got to speak to people like Steven Weinberg and all this kind of stuff, and it was very exciting. And then I spoke to the graduate students, and they were uniformly miserable, and they said, "Don't come here." And I was really, I was sort of crestfallen. And I had actually had a nice offer from Caltech, but at that point in my life, I wasn't really thinking about leaving the Northeast. So I went down to Princeton. I spoke to the students there. They were also fairly miserable, but not quite as miserable as the students at Harvard. And I said, okay, I'll go there. At that time, I still wasn't sure what branch of physics I wanted to do. I was thinking of high energy physics at that time. I knew I was going to be a theorist. I did like lab work, but my real heart was in theory and particularly mathematics. And, So I the first year I was there, I spoke to the other graduate students. I sort of looked around, and at that time, and I that's when Phil Anderson, my first year at Princeton was in 1975, and that was the year that Phil first came to Princeton as well. And some of the other students had said, if you want to work with a real theoretical physicist, Phil Anderson is, he works in all kinds of different areas, does all kinds of interesting things. And I started looking at some of his papers, and I thought that this would be the person that I would want to work with. So I went to talk to him. This was, I guess, around 1976. And he said, well, we'll see how you do in the general exams Princeton gives. And then after that, we'll see. So I did well in the generals, and Phil immediately took me on. And interestingly, I had been working with him for a total of 1 month when he won the Nobel Prize, which I suppose it did not come as a surprise to other people, but I did not know Phil very well then. And I guess that was my first brush with it, you might say. it was a very interesting time.
So
let me just add one thing. I think the thing that drew me to condensed matter physics was that there was a much wider range of problems that one could work on than in other areas. I had been interested in astrophysics originally, but the work that was being done at that time, it's changed a lot since then, but this was the late 70s. Just a lot of the stuff then didn't appeal to me terribly much. And in particle physics, everybody was pretty much working on the same problem or a very small subset of problems. Whereas condensed matter physics, there was a huge variety of problems, from very abstract and mathematical to very applied, borderline with engineering, particularly electrical engineering. And I thought that there's a whole palette of problems to choose from, and I decided this would be the area that I would go into.
So your PhD work, when Anderson, was not spinglass related, but were you following developments in the field at that time?
Well, in fact, yes. Not that closely. At that time, yes. Phil had suggested I work on the properties of topological properties of order parameters in condensed matter systems, and that's what I wrote my thesis on. But I also wrote a number of other papers sort of on my own, on liquid crystals, on some renormalization group stuff, because that was all the rage back then. That's what many people who were getting degrees in condensed matter physics, they wrote their papers on renormalization group, because in the early 70s, Ken Wilson did his thing, and so it was very popular then. But I was a graduate student from 1975 to 1979, which you might consider the heroic age of theoretical spin glasses. 1975, both Edwards Anderson and Sherrington and Kirkpatrick came out with their papers. And then in 77 and 78, you had Thallus, Anderson, Palmer, you had the Alameda Thallus. But there were also other things going on. I mean, localization theory, the Gang of Four, if you remember, came out around 1978, plus or minus a year. And so there was a huge ferment. But I do remember, and then, of course, in 1979, Giorgio came out with the replica symmetry breaking solution of the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. I do remember hearing a talk. So I wasn't working on spin glasses or glasses at that time, but I was quite interested. And I do remember hearing a talk, I'm not sure by whom, it probably was Richard Palmer. And I remember that a lot of discussion was on the Thallus Anderson Palmer theory, which was or solution, which was brand new. And I thought to myself, at some point, I definitely want to have a closer look at this problem.
So do you remember your reaction to yours and Phil Anderson's reaction to the Parisi solution in 79, if you were following that closely? How did you react to it, or was it a non-event?
I remember no reaction at all. I think at that time, Phil was heavily involved in other things. He was very deeply invested at that point in the single particle localization theory, because there were a lot of theories at that time about whether the metal insulator transition, whether there was a gap or not, a jump in the conductivity at the metal insulator transition in two and three dimensions, and some papers that I know Phil was not happy with, and so I think he probably spoke to others about it, but I don't recall any particular reaction at that time. But I think though that Phil's attention was, was very involved in neutron stars at that time, extremely involved in localization and a whole amorphous semiconductors, a lot of other problems. So I'm sure he noticed it, but what his reaction was, I could not tell you.
So one of your first works on spin glasses concerned the Ising spin chain with a frustrated Hamiltonian, a one-dimensional spin chain that has a varying interaction range. Can you walk us through what motivated this model and what led to its genesis?
Oh God, that was so long ago. I don't remember. Well, Gabi Kotliar really, I think, was the primary driver of that work. I wish I could remember how we first started thinking about that. Let's see, that came out in the early 80s. I think, that was, I guess, probably the first, probably was the first paper that I was involved in directly with spin glasses. But I remember we had a lot of conversations about spin glasses and, I really don't recall anymore, how that particular model came up, how it was proposed and so on. I remember that, we had started thinking about doing high temperature expansions, which I believe was the first part of the paper. And then I think Gabi pushed a lot to forward the low temperature part of that paper as well. And we were particularly excited by the fact that, when you did this conversion from the power law decay to the dimensionality in nearest neighbor models like Edwards-Anderson model, we found that the specific heat was continuous right at that point, which of course was quite exciting because the specific heat of spin glasses experimentally had been measured not to have any jumps at the critical temperature. I wish I could tell you more. I honestly don't remember many of the details or how we came to the model. I do remember though that Gabi really was the main driver of that work and deserves a lot of the credit for that.
And Professor Newman, were you following any of this work at that time?
So the short answer is no. I was certainly interested. As a graduate student and my thesis, was involved more in the kind of general quantum field theory point of view, and particularly in those years, which would have been the late 60s, early 70s. And then when my first position after the PhD at NYU, where Jim Glim was a faculty member, so I was very interested in constructive quantum field theory and things like phi to the fourth quantum field models and their connections with Ising models. But actually not, I didn't know anything about spin glasses. I think I maybe had heard the word, but I think, my first real contact with it was when Dan and I were faculty members together at the University of Arizona. And that would have been, I think, something like 1987. Is that right? So I was very interested in Ising models and sort of renormalization group theory in the Ising ferromagnet context. But I didn't really know anything about spin glasses. And I'm sure he quickly let me know that was an interesting topic to think about. And then we started working together. I wanted to add one thing about, I mentioned this uncle of mine, Marvin Camrys. He was described him as an engineer, which is correct, but he was actually one of the original developers of magnetic tape recording. He eventually won a national, what used to be called a National Medal of Engineering. I think the name is somehow changed somewhat, but he won all kinds of awards from Japan because they, like with a number of other things, they developed things originated in the U.S. They developed much more quickly and further. Yeah, so.
In the mid 70s, you were interested in notions of metastability, right?
Yes.
In following your work in at the Technion, I think, if I remember.
Yes, so, that's correct. That's right. The mid 70s, I spent I think a year at the Technion on some. I was already a faculty member at Indiana University, but I sort of took off a year to get, I had a kind of postdoc at the Technion, and Larry Shulman actually was the one who suggested that the metastability is an interesting question. Larry Shulman was simultaneously a professor at Indiana University and at the Technion. He used to kind of go back and forth. So that's right. We started working on that then. And I've worked on metastability related questions and other times. I remember one time when Michael Eisenwald and I were one semester, we're both in residence in Bure Sur Yvette. We tried very hard to figure out, something to do with metastability. That didn't work out particularly well, I guess. But at the same time, we had a second project, which was one over distance squared, one-dimensional Ising ferromagnets and related models. that worked out better. But we said, okay, we can't figure out metastability, so let's work on this easier problem.
And you mentioned you both being at Arizona, but Professor Newman, you were there before Professor Stein. Were you in any way involved in his recruitment there?
I don't think so. I don't think at all.
We didn't know each other. I think at that point.
Yes. No. I was completely in the mathematics department. Although I talked to some people in physics, and he came in the physics department, and then we met and discovered we had lots of interests in common, and spin glasses turned out to be the kind of main one. Well, I mean, I hadn't had it in common before, quickly got involved. Yes.
Came naturally.
Let me just add a couple of things to that. Actually, our first paper together was not on spin glasses. It was on some obscure problem having to do with whether or not you had percolation of majority spins below TC, something like that. In fact, I could just say the first time I met Chuck, actually, at that time, the physics department, Peter Carruthers had just come in as the head of the physics department. And I think he just tried to recruit me, but at the same time he tried to recruit Lincoln and Jennifer Chase, and the three of us came the same day to interview, and Lincoln and Jennifer at that time were working with Chuck, and I just sort of tagged along with them, and I think Chuck, that's the first time that you and I met. I remember that Lincoln and Jennifer kept saying, okay, come on, let's get to work, and they were not so interested in the interview. They wanted to start working right then and there. And anyway, I ended up coming to Arizona, and I guess I went to UCLA, where Lincoln still is, if I'm right about that.
Yes, I think that's right. Yes, they definitely did not come to Arizona.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I could say more later if you want, but I'll stop here for now. We can come back to this if you'd like.
Yeah, well, I'd like to take a step back in time also, because we skipped over a key period. Following a meeting at the ESPEN Center for Physics, Professor Stein, you co-authored a paper entitled Models of Hierarchical Constraint Dynamics for Glassy Relaxation.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about that work and how that collaboration came about?
Sure, that I remember much better. So when I had gotten my PhD from the period of 1979 to maybe 1982 or 83, I was working on other problems altogether. I was very interested at that time in quantum liquids and superfluids and things like that. I did a lot of work on neutron stars and superfluid helium 3. Jim Sawes had come to Princeton from Stony Brook at that time, and he and I worked together on a lot of problems. And so that was mostly what I was working on, but I had remembered, and of course, but at that time, I guess I wasn't completely, there was the work with Gabi and Phil on the 1D long range spin glass, but I remained very, very interested in the problem of disordered systems. And I don't remember exactly how I got started to migrate over to that area, but I do know that at some point in 82 or 83, Richard Palmer and I started talking about various problems, not in spin glasses, but in structural glasses. I mean, we talked about spin glasses too, but our main interest was in dynamical relaxation, particularly these alpha relaxations in glassy liquids. And in particular, the Kohlrausch-Williams-Watts law we were interested in, the Fulcher law, all of these kinds of anomalous relaxation behaviors really got our interest, and we started thinking about timescales. And Richard had written a very long paper about broken ergodicity that appeared in, I think, Advances in Physics in 82. So we had started, working together for a very, and of course now in the renormalization group, was still very much in the air, and we started, and so Richard and I started thinking about, what about, and of course, hierarchies were very much in the air because of the Parisi solution of the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. And so, you know, we started thinking, you know, well, what if there are fast degrees of freedom that have to unlock slower degrees of freedom and so on and so forth. And, you know, we spoke to Elihu and Phil about that as well. And that became the so-called PSAA paper, which, you know, in a way, I don't know whether to, I still don't know quite what to think of that. In some sense, it was a model of, you know, not based on any first principles or anything like that. It was sort of based on an idea. But it's, I think it's my most highly cited paper. and it still is being cited. So I think the physics community must think more highly of the paper than I do at this point. But it seemed to have been an interesting paper. But it did grow out of this discussion between Richard Palmer and me, and the influences at that time, which were very much in the air, were renormalization group theory and also hierarchies a la replica symmetry breaking.
And what role played the Center for Physics, the Aspen Center for Physics, in there?
I don't recall much about that, but I think there probably was. That may well be where Richard Palmer and I met. I wish I could say more, especially because I've been involved with the Aspen Center for Physics for many, many years. And I do want to give it its just due, and it's their fault that my memory is a little hazy. I don't know where I would have met Richard, because I don't think he was at Princeton at that time. So I think there probably was some kind of meeting at that time on disordered systems. I probably was at that meeting because I was going every summer at that point, skipping a few years, but I certainly must have been there in 82, 83 when these things were very much in the air. That is probably, I can't be 100% sure, but that is probably where Richard Palmer and I met and started our discussions. And Elihu and Phil probably were there too, because they were always at the center as well. So the Aspen Center for Physics, so thank you for reminding me of that, because I had completely forgotten it. And I'm not 100% sure about it, but I think it's not more than 90% likely that that's probably where all of this got started.
In 1988, again with Richard Palmer, you made a different proposal about glassy dynamics that presents some similarities with the Potts-Glass analogy of Kirkpatrick and Wolness.
Right.
How closely were you following these works, or how influenced were you back and forth between these ideas?
Well, I think that, in 1987, just before when I was making my transition from Princeton to Arizona, from January to June, I co-directed a workshop in, you know, glassy system and glassy relaxation and proteins and all this kind of stuff. And my other, the two other co-directors were Richard Palmer and Peter Wolinis. So we had a lot of discussions about these things, and there was a lot of interest in whether there was a hidden phase transition somehow underlying the glass transition. I also remember that there was some interesting renormalization group work by Hassenfratz that I don't remember the details of that anymore. And I think even later, Alan Sokol had followed up on that work and had found some problems with that. But I think that provided the germ of the idea that led to this work that Richard and I had done on glasses. That was work that I sort of forgot about pretty quickly afterward, because at that point I was making the transition to glasses, which became, you know, a very hard transition when I went to Arizona and Chuck and I started working together. At that point, I more or less dropped out of doing the stuff on glasses. And I don't think I've done anything on glasses since then, on structural glasses, that is. That all of these things, again, were in the air. And that workshop in Santa Barbara, I'm sure, is where much of these ideas and discussions took place.
In 1985, you also proposed an analogy between spinning glasses and proteins and substates of proteins.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that predates that workshop. So where did your interest in this problem and the idea for the analogy come from?
Yeah. Okay, so this I do remember. So two things. Again, things that were in the air was spin glasses in the early 80s. Well, you know, Phil Anderson had given a talk at an inaugural conference of what became the Santa Fe Institute, spin glass Hamiltonians, a bridge to other problems, you know, computer science and biology and so on. Kirkpatrick and Gelad and Becky had done their work on simulated annealing, and John Hopfield has done his work on neural networks. Phil had done work on prebiotic evolution, you know, all of these with spin glass analogies. So that was in the air. But what really got that work started was in 83 or 84, you know, I was at Princeton, and I really did enjoy biological physics quite a lot. And I had many discussions with Saul Gruner and Bob Austin, who were experimentalists, biophysics experimentalists at the time. And Bob approached me. He had a prop, he said that they had some very interesting data on protein he had been working with Hans Fraunfelder on relaxation of proteins after a photo disassociation of the myoglobin and the heme group. You know, they did flash photolysis, which broke the bond. The iron atom would diffuse around the protein matrix, and then it would get rebound, and they looked at these relaxation times. And Bob had done a number of these experiments, and he had very slow relaxations. And we spoke about, and he asked me if I could, if I recall correctly, you may want to ask him, he may have a different memory, but my recollection is that he said, you know, do you think you can, you want to think about this? And I said, you know, that looks an awful lot like this kinds of relaxations that I've seen in spin glasses. I sort of did on my own. I sat down. I mean, well, of course, lots of discussions with the experimentalists, but no discussions with the theorists. I think I talked to Phil about it at some point. And Phil said, yeah, that's a good idea. You should pursue that, you know, and more or less like just encouragement. Anyway, so I thought of a model of, the relaxation due to flipping between conformational substates of the protein, which one could think about as, you know, many metastable states, not ground state kinds of things, but many metastable states around the tertiary structure. And then it got published in PNAS in 1985 as a model of protein conformational substates using the spin glass analogy.
So in 1989, Peter Wallnis with Wallnis and Brennwein, and then with Kirkpatrick and Ryan Wallnis, published two papers on those two fields that were clearly related. What was your reaction to these works?
Well, I had been in a lot of conversations with Peter Wallnis, and he was very interested in these problems. And I remember thinking many times that the protein folding problem would be very interesting to apply this to. I know I was not the only one. But the phenomenology, the phenomenology of protein conformational dynamics was fairly straightforward. The phenomenology of protein folding is, the experimental data, the list of phenomena and exceptions and exceptions to the exceptions and so on were so overwhelming that I felt that to try to do any kind of modeling of protein folding would be very difficult to do if one wanted to take into account all of the experimental data. That was probably my mistake because, a number of other people went ahead and said, well, we don't have to worry about taking into account of everything. Let's just come up with a model that will do this. But my reaction, I was very happy to see spin glass ideas being applied to other problems in protein dynamics. Peter and I were good friends, and we'd had a lot of conversations about these things. And we probably discussed these things, although to be honest, I don't recall any specific conversations, but it must have come up. But I was delighted, to see that, because sometimes you do something and it's like a drop in the ocean and it disappears. But this seemed to be an idea that, even if my work in 85 played any role at all in leading to that other work, I was extremely gratified. I can't speak to that myself because other people did that work, but clearly it did follow from it, and it's been a very successful theory.
You've mentioned the school you ran in 1987, and in the published lecture notes for that school, you mentioned that the school organization presented some challenges. Were any of those challenges science-related or just the usual?
Are you referring to the summer school on complex systems?
Am I confusing the two? So there was.
I have a feeling. Yeah, there was okay. A summer school on complex systems that I, I was the first director of. It's still going to this day, run by the Santa Fe Institute. The first one was in 1988. That certainly had a lot of challenges, including having to find the money, having to decide what complex systems meant, deciding who to invite and all of that. But that was a whole different thing. We can talk about that later if you'd like, but that may be getting us off topic.
Sure. No. So then I would like to know what motivated you to organize the summer school then?
I was just being hired at the University of Arizona, and I was very junior at the time, and the Santa Fe Institute was still getting started at that point. They were housed in a convent, a former convent that was eventually taken back by the church, but they were housed in this convent, and it was a shoestring operation at that time. And Peter Carruthers called me up that summer, just as I was the summer of 87. At that point, my wife was pregnant with our first child. I had a lot of stuff going on. And Pete Carruthers asked me, they said that they'd like to start a summer school on complex systems. Would I be interested in directing it? And, I said, sure. I had no idea what I was getting into. In December, I went to Santa Fe and spoke to George Cowan, who was the president of the Santa Fe Institute at the time. At that point, I was told that, they're happy to support it, but not financially because they didn't have any money. I had to go out and find the funding and everything else. The thing is that no one do it. If there were other complex systems summer schools at that time, I was unaware of them. I'm not sure there were any. First we had to find the funding, and I was helped by some people like Mike Simmons in particular, helped a lot, David Campbell and other people. But we did manage to get, we needed about $200,000 to run this school. And I was terrified that, we wouldn't be able to get the funding. But amazingly, we did. We got funding from Research Corporation, from DOE, the Sloan Foundation. And NSF came on the next year, when Sloan Foundation only does it for 1 year and then they drop out. They just do the initial push. So we got the money, and then, I had to decide, What are complex systems? Who should I invite? All of this kind of stuff. Again, I got help from more senior people, but it was mostly on me. So it was quite stressful at the time. But in the end, it was a very successful school. We had a lot of students and participants. It was a Woodstock feeling in the air at that time, like something new was being created. And it was wonderful. However, I said that I was, when I was out, that took an enormous amount of my time. Erica Jen ran it the second year and asked me to be co-director under her. I said, sure. But then after that, Erica said she'd had enough. I ended up running the summer school for the next 10 years, some years in co-directing with Lynn Nadel, a psychology professor at Arizona. But after 10 years, I said, it's really time for you to find somebody else to do this. But as I said, it's still going on, and that's something that I'm very proud of, in fact. I think that's been a very successful enterprise.
So yeah, absolutely. In the notes that were published, I think it's about the first edition. There were lecture notes published, right? You mentioned that. Richard, you wrote a number of the chapters with Richard Palmer there as well on spin glasses and on structural glasses. So in one of the chapters, you mentioned that a more physical scaling theory approach to spin glasses had been developed and that this approach was attractive. So I was curious to know, in your eyes, what was particularly attractive about this proposal at the time?
I have no recollection of this. So did we reference what this scaling proposal was?
Or? Sure. It's the approach of...
It was Fisher. Was that the Fisher and Hughes proposal?
Yes. That's what you call the scaling theory.
Okay. No, of course that's a scaling theory. There was a lot of talk about scaling theories of glasses at that time and so on. So I wasn't sure if you were referring to those. So I apologize for that. So what's the question now about?
So what is it that you found attractive about that proposal? This is before you doing any work in this area.
Right. Well, at that time, I was, of course, the Parisi solution at that time had dominated everything. In fact, I'm sure you have, somewhere I'd written a paper with Andrew Ogielski solving a dynamical problem on ultrametric spaces. So when the Fisher-Hughes paper came out, I thought it was a beautiful paper. It was sharp. It was crystalline in its, beauty. Crystalline may be an interesting word to use in this context, but and I thought that they really had something there. There was no way of knowing who could possibly be right, but I think that in fact this is probably what led me to start thinking about trying to do more serious mathematical work, and could have been an impetus for initially, for Chuck and I ending up working together. Because what happened at that point, and I remember very vividly, is that I was beginning to, I sort of was interested in neutron stars for a while. I sort of left that field because I felt that, well, the theories were very interesting and enjoyable and fun to work with. There was no way of really knowing which of these theories of, what was going on in the core of the neutron stars and things like that were correct, whether it was quark matter or, all of these other, exotic phases that people were wondering about. And I left it for that reason. And I was beginning to get that same feeling with spin glasses. There are all these theories floating around. They were extremely difficult to verify experimentally or numerically, especially numerically. Numerical simulations were being done, and some of them seemed to support the scaling theory, some of them seemed to support RSB, and even the same numerical simulations, people argued about which theory it supported. And I was also aware that the work of John Imbrie had come out a little bit earlier, in which he rigorously resolved this controversy about in random field Ising magnets, whether the lower critical dimension was 2 or 3, and he was able to resolve that rigorously. It was a few years later that Eisenman and Vare then did their work on this problem. And all of these things together started to make me think that, it may be that, I was a student of Phil. Phil always, he did have a bit of an attitude toward mathematical physics. He would love to say that mathematicians or mathematical physicists were able to prove things that ordinary theoretical physicists understood 30 years prior. And that was true to a large extent for a lot of things, but it was not true for the random field Ising magnet. And it started to make me think, maybe the right way to go about this is to stop coming up with all of these models and all of this and start trying to do some rigorous work. The problem was at that time that I did not have the background and training needed for that. So, you know, when Chuck and I met and started talking about these things, I remember I was trying to push a paper on him when I first got there that I'd written with Michael Barber and Xudan Liang and I guess Bhaskaran was the other author on the plus or minus J model in 2 and 3 dimensions, ground states and things like that. That paper disappeared. And it wasn't, although I've seen papers that have come out recently that have many of the same ideas in them, which is sort of, it's always amusing when you're around in a field long enough, you see these kinds of things happening. But, you know, so Chuck had said that, you know, he was doing lots of very interesting work on all of these statistical mechanics models, including these using spin models, but mostly ferromagnetic. And, you know, and I had done some work at this point on spin glasses, but I didn't really have the mathematical background. And so, you know, when we got together, you know, there was a back and forth about, you know, learning about spin glasses on one side and learning about the mathematics and probability theory that was needed to really do look at these things in a serious way, in my opinion. And that's how I guess our collaboration got started, although Chuck may want to add to that. He may have different memories. Plus, I've been talking a lot, and I think, well, it's up to you, Patrick. As to,
yeah, you know, that's precisely the question I wanted to ask. So Professor Newman, in your eyes, what did you find compelling about Professor Stein's proposals or the spinning glass model at this point?
Yeah, so I would agree with his assessment that you know, basically that the spin glass models and in particular short range ones are so difficult to understand no matter what methods you use that more rigorous mathematical approaches you know, maybe more worthwhile than they are in settings where things are you know, things can be studied non-rigorously, you know, and get accurate results. I think I used to say sometimes in talks that or maybe just in personal communications that so, you know, people try to do study physics models from a rigorous mathematical point of view are usually at a big disadvantage because it's very slow and it takes years or even decades to get results. And so, you know, meanwhile, as Phil Anderson used to say, you know, 30 years before, the problem was already resolved to everybody else's satisfaction by non-rigorous methods. And so often there are, you know, non-rigorous sort of theoretical physics modeling, and then there are also computational things which have been more and more important in lots of areas, and then you know, a third kind of option are rigorous mathematical methods, and in most areas the rigorous mathematical methods are decades late compared to the other methods. But spin glasses, and in particular short range spin glasses, seem to be so difficult that all, you know, that the competition is more equal, and so that was actually one of the reasons that I found it kind of exciting that we were not that those approaches were not necessarily at a disadvantage compared to the other one. Both theoretical physics modeling and computational ones are both extraordinarily difficult. And so everybody's at the same disadvantage.
I should just add quickly that while most of the work that Chuck and I have done together is rigorous, we were not above doing some non-rigorous analyses when we felt that we had something to contribute that was at least believable. So
in the first paper you wrote together on spin glasses, you also here again acknowledged the Aspen Center for Physics, a meeting taking place there. Can you describe, I mean, was this meeting really helpful? And if yes, what is it about it that was helpful?
So I'm not sure who you're directing that to, but I'm
to either of you. This is, personally, you were both there.
I'm not sure what meeting that would be. I mean, I went to one of the relatively early summer schools.
Yes, that's right.
So it might be that, but I don't remember any any details now.
You know, yeah, all I could say is that, you know, if, you know, Chuck, no, I remember, Chuck, you were in Aspen in 1990. And the reason I remember that is two reasons. One is Jennifer babysat Laura, daughter babysat my oldest daughter. And also we were caught in a thunderstorm at the top of Mount Aspen. So you were there in 1990. And so that, yes, that must have been the meeting where our discussions, you know, at that point, Chuck and I had been working together for a couple of years. Originally, we were thinking about, you know, trying to prove a phase transition in the Edwards Anderson model. And I think that's where these ideas of double FK percolation first started coming about. I think Michael Eisenman may have also been talking about these things at the same time, although I don't recall very well. But I think that that 1992 paper, I do think that its genesis was at the Aspen Center for Physics in the summer of 1990. And as often happens, both our 92 paper and our 95 papers, or little papers that were published in 96, you know, where we first directly addressed replica symmetry breaking application of short range spin glasses, we were trying to prove something else. And, you know, or at least we were looking at another problem and then somehow realized something that applied to these kinds of problems. Chuck, do you remember much about the origins of the 92 paper? I do remember our intense discussions about it back at Courant, because at that time I was still at Arizona. Chuck was at Courant, he moved in 89, but I would make many, many visits to, also my wife is from New York and her whole family was in New York. And so that worked out very well. Whenever we could, we'd be in New York. So I spent a lot of time at Courant at that time. But Chuck, what do you remember about the origins of the 92 paper?
Not very much, I'm afraid.
So, yeah. So Professor Newman,
I do remember one thing. I'm sorry, Patrick, but you could ask your question. It depends if you
want to. No, go ahead, please.
Okay. What I do remember is this. Somehow we had, it turns out that there's an extremely simple art. So originally that paper, I think, was we were working on, well, we were able to prove a bound on the amount of, if you look at the expectation of, let's say, sigma x, sigma y squared, right, an edge variable, averaged, you know, thermally averaged, and then averaged over all of the couplings, we found a bound on that, that, you know, was greater than or equal to one minus a constant over beta as beta, well, for any beta, but as beta goes to infinity, it's interesting. And we thought originally at that point that this was very, so we had a long argument for it, and I don't remember anymore what it was. Turns out that you can actually prove it in about one line, and it ended up being a footnote in the 92 paper. We have this bound in this footnote. At first we thought, does this mean that maybe there really are only two states, you know, two ground states, a single pair? We quickly realized that it did not imply that. And I think that's what led to the 92 paper, which actually I think is one of our nicest pieces of work together on this problem. That was a nice paper. But Chuck, do you remember anything more about that?
No.
So President Newman, so at that time, right, especially 1992, 1993, there were various mathematicians and mathematical physicists who got interested in the SK model. So Francisco Guerra started about that time, Michel Talagrand as well. Did the thought of jumping on that story cross your mind, or you, it was always for you a finite connectivity interest?
Well, I think it's related to what I said before. That is, unlike from ferromagnets, the infinite range model, the SK model, is not at all simple. I think it's extremely interesting. Still, maybe maybe, you know, after the influence of, certainly after the influence of Dan, you know, I decided that the, you know, even more fundamental problem were the short range models, and there, you know, there the, you know, we, as I said before, the more rigorous mathematical approach was, you know, so more on an equal footing with the other approaches, because everybody found it almost impossible, all the methods. And so, you know, why not just, you know, continue working on that one? I remember having some brief discussion with, what's his name? The French mathematician.
Talleyrand, Michel Talleyrand.
Yeah, Talleyrand, right. who thought that I was, we were completely nuts working on that impossible problem. Why not work on something you could actually get, you know, get, make some progress?
He's probably right.
Yeah, probably right, yes.
How was your collaboration synergistic? I mean, what were the complementary skills that the both of you were bringing to the problem at that point?
I guess we can both say something about that. But I had somewhat more training in mathematical techniques and, you know, and rigorous kind of approaches to things, and Dan certainly had more understanding of the physics literature and what were the physically interesting issues to think about. So I think we actually complemented each other rather well.
Please, Professor Sen.
No, I mean, you know, yeah. So what Chuck says is, I mean, that certainly is how our collaboration started out, and you know, and it's, I think that's more or less been true throughout. Although, I think that a lot of each of us has rubbed off on the other. Maybe one could put it. Maybe over the years, I've become more rigorous, and Chuck has become less rigorous. But I mean that in a good way. The point is that, you know, I certainly have become over the last few decades much more, you know, mathematical in my thinking about things, and I think that Chuck has probably become more physical in his thinking about things. And so, you know, I mean, at this point, you know, we both come up with ideas, we both come up with, you know, methods, you know, how to attack, you know, methods for, you know, how to prove things and so on. And, you know, it's just been a, you know, wonderful collaboration. It's, you know, it really has, I think, probably been, you know, one of the highlights of my career, you know, and one of the most enjoyable collaborations that I've had. And I've had many of them, many of which have been very fruitful and very enjoyable.
Yeah. So let me add that, you know, I have no, unlike some people, so because I sort of somehow started out in physics, I suppose, unlike some mathematicians who go into mathematical physics, I have nothing against, you know, doing work which is not completely rigorous. The only thing I try to be careful about is how you advertise it. You know, if you say that something was rigorously proved, it should be rigorously proved.
Right.
You know, if you do something which is not completely rigorous, then that's fine and very useful and can be a great contribution. But just say what the situation is.
Yeah, we try to be very careful in our papers to say what the assumptions are, you know, that are going in. And you know, that's something that we do try to be extremely careful about. We also try to be very, very careful about trying to, you know, make sure that we do, and I'm sure that we have not been perfect in this because nobody is, it's impossible, but we do try to be very careful about referencing people who deserve, you know, should be referenced and all the rest of that. I just hope that we've done a reasonably good job of that.
So Professor Newman, having worked on the meta state or in meta stable states in particular, did you have a particular intuition about the behavior of finite range spinning glasses when you first started thinking about it? I understand that Professor Stein brought a lot of the physics lore to it, but
So I don't think, since I didn't know much about it in the beginning, I don't think I had any preconceived notions. And the Medisafe, which I think is, I hope will be regarded as one of our contributions to the, not just spin glasses, but general disordered systems, was something that we, you know, somehow were kind of felt forced into. I mean, we didn't know how we were, for example, trying to understand the replica symmetry breaking picture within a rigorous point of view, and we understood the general idea, but we just couldn't somehow make precise sense out of it. And at some point or other, we just had no alternative almost than thinking about the phenomenon of chaotic size dependence, in which you don't have just a simple thermodynamic limit, but different scales, you see different states. And that led to thinking about the Medisafe. And then at that point, we realized that a very similar picture, but from a somewhat different point of view, had already been done by Eisenman and Baer. So we've been careful to, describe this object as, there are two different ways in which you can think of it, but they end up giving basically the same object.
Patrick, you said metastable states. Did you mean metastable?
So he had worked on metastable states before, in the mid-70s, right? I was trying to see if there was a connection.
Not much of a connection, I would say. Yeah.
Okay. I did write a paper on metastable states, though, in random ferromagnets and spin glasses, and were able to prove a lot of results. This paper appeared in 99 or 2000, 98, somewhere around there. We were able to prove that in all dimensions, including one, you have a continuous disorder distribution, both spin glasses and random ferromagnets have an uncountable infinity of metastable states. One spin flip, two spin flip, three spin flip, all the way up, any K spin flip.
I don't think we've done anything in which those two things have been connected to each other.
No, but I'm just addressing the metastable state.
Maybe that's a good idea.
but I think one thing that's important from that is that people often talk about disorder and frustration, and disorder and frustration together do make the spin glass problem extremely difficult to analyze. But it's also true that you don't need both for a lot of the phenomena that you do see in a lot of these systems. Sometimes disorder alone is enough, as in the random ferromagnet having many, many metastable states, and therefore would also have slow relaxation. But since Chuck brought up the metastate, I mean, that I agree with Chuck that probably is one of our most important contributions. And, maybe we could talk a little bit about that if you would like.
I have a comment about that, or a continuing comment. I remember very clearly spending a large part of a day sitting with Dan in Washington Square Park, trying to decide on what we should call this object. and I think I had written down a long list of maybe 20 possible names, and we kind of ruled out one after the other for various reasons, and after a while, that was the only one that was left standing.
Chuck always had a great talent for coming up with wonderful names for things. Unfortunately, most of those could not be used. but about the metastate, though, I do think that this is an important thing. I mean, so back when we, 1995, I remember, was the summer. I spent the entire summer, not the entire summer, but much of the summer in New York working with Chuck. And that's when, we had originally, were working on looking at ground states in the two-dimensional ferromagnet. I'm sorry, the two-dimensional spin glass. and it was out of that this flurry of papers that were published in 1996 came. So people were talking about spin glasses a lot. The thing is that I don't think anybody at that time seemed to have a very clear idea of what replica symmetry breaking even meant in the short range Edwards Anderson model. You start to say, there's many pure states and they're all ultrametric and things like that. So originally what happened is that first Chuck and I said, how can we even construct the thermodynamic state? You know, some people were even saying, I remember seeing papers written by very prominent people, maybe, it doesn't even have any meaning for spin glasses in the thermodynamic limit, which certainly was not, pure concept of pure states and so on, which is certainly not true. But we were thinking, we know they exist, but the question is, how can one construct them? And so, it was a lot of work, but, we did have a procedure where you do lots of averaging and so on and take the limit and so on. And we were able to generate a thermodynamic state, which we now know is the Barry center of the metastate. It was immediately clear that this state could not support the basic, it did not have non-self averaging of overlaps and ultrametricity and all of this kind of stuff. We published that paper, and that created a lot of controversy. And we also had discussions with Francesco Guerra, knew Chuck, he didn't know me, so he'd written to Chuck with some comments that led to, I think, our thinking about maybe we should think about how one could incorporate replica symmetry breaking the spin glasses, short range spin glasses. Maybe there was a way. And then, as Chuck said, we had to deal with problems like chaotic size dependence, which we had uncovered in the 1992 paper. And that led to the metastate, which at that time, at least I think we were both, we knew about the Eisenbaer paper. The thing is that what they had done, the metastate, was tucked away in an appendix. And I think we were probably unaware of that. I know I was, I think Chuck was too. We came up with the idea of the metastate for the spin glass. And I think it was shortly thereafter. I think Chuck, you mentioned to me that Eisen and Mayer had done something similar. This was after we had written the paper. But I don't remember if somebody had mentioned that to you, or do you remember how you found out about that?
I don't really remember.
But I do remember you told me, I had read the Eisenbaer paper. In fact, that was one of the things that got me extremely excited. I was at Arizona, and Chuck had already gone to NYU. Bill Farris at the math department at Arizona gave a talk, a special seminar on the Eisenbaer. I remember he was mostly interested in the Martingale central limit theorem, which was a centerpiece of the Eisenbaer proof, that you had rounding of the phase transition in a two-dimensional zero temperature random field Ising model. And that got me very, very excited. I think that may have been, that talk did a lot to really turn me on to really thinking hard about, how to do rigorous modeling, rigorous proofs of short range spin glasses. But in any case, I read the paper, but the technical appendices, I don't know, I probably looked at, but I don't remember anymore, but I was mostly concerned with the bulk of the paper. I'm pretty sure, I know that when we wrote that, we were unaware of that Eisenman and Bear had done something similar for the RFIM. And I do remember that shortly after we had done that, Chuck sent me an email saying, take a look at Eisenman and Bear's Appendix A. They've done something similar for the random field Ising model. But I assume, Chuck, that somebody must have mentioned that to you, because I don't think we were looking at the paper at that time. It was years after it had been written.
Yeah, so it could have been Michael Eisenman who pointed it out. But
That is very possible. Yes.
So you mentioned the 1996 paper as stirring some controversy, which I think must be related to the claim that you write that we provide rigorous proofs which show that the main features of the Parisi solution of the SK spinning glass as applied to more realistic spinning glass models are not valid in any dimension at any temperature, right? Mm-hmm. at the time you wrote these words, was this the proof of the program you had embarked on? That you, was this what you thought was the end point of what of your work?
No, not at all. I don't think we thought that at the time. In fact, you know, even as that paper was published, we were working hard on trying to figure out how replica symmetry breaking could be. We probably should have phrased this a little bit differently, but what we were trying to say in that paper was that the picture that had been, I think that was in most people's minds at that time, was that, because, you know, I'd spoken to a lot of people at Aspen and other places about this, and, you know, they were giving talks saying that, you know, that the spin glass, you know, there are many pure states, and that, you know, when you look at their overlaps, it's non-self-averaging, and that they, you know, they form an ultrametric structure. It turned out it was not that simple. And so what we really showed is that you cannot construct any thermodynamic state that, you know, by itself could have all of, you know, that the answer did not lie in a single thermodynamic state. You know, I think that is really what we were trying to say. And I think that was counter to what many people were thinking at the time. You know, we later came up with what we then called a non-standard RSB picture, or the non-standard SK picture, which was, I think, a very different way of looking at how replica symmetry breaking would apply to short-range spin glasses. And, you know, I spoke to a lot of people at Aspen about it. And, you know, it clearly was not a picture that had been in anyone's minds that I was aware of. Now I think it is in fact, we were able to prove, and then later Nick Reed showed using theoretic methods, you know, this is really the only way in which replica symmetry breaking can manifest itself in short range models. Chuck, do you want to add to that?
Well, yeah, so I think that earlier way we had presented things was because at the time, I would say we thought that, we think that the RSB picture of short range models is likely or has a good chance of being incorrect. But in order to show that it's incorrect, you first have to formulate it clearly so you can then, you know, try to prove that it's incorrect. Right. And so we have succeeded, I would say, in the formulation, but it's not yet determined whether it's incorrect or not.
Right. Yeah, we don't know the answer to that. We have come up with rigorous arguments, you know, that in using the metastate and its invariance under certain gauge transformations that lead us to believe that, certainly led us to believe very strongly at that time, and I think still to some extent, that it would be very hard, you know, not that it's impossible, because, you know, the rigorous part, you know, there's a certain part of it that's rigorous. From that, we were led to believe that it would be difficult for replica symmetry breaking to, there were so many constraints it had to satisfy, it was hard for us to see how it could satisfy all of them. We did say, though, in that paper that that's not a proof of anything, but we do believe that, you know, this invariance of the metastate, and this was later now, this was in the late 90s, made it hard to imagine how replica symmetry breaking could survive in finite dimensions. However, I would say that, you know, but, you know, in follow-up papers, you know, we have written papers that, you know, sort of, we actually wrote a paper in 2016, I think, with Louis Pierre Argan, in which we, who was a former postdoc of ours, in which we proved a number of thermodynamic identities. And in that, we, and we looked at, and we checked the replica symmetry breaking, and, you know, what we found in that paper is that, it looked like these thermodynamic identities. Well, we said, suppose you had a mixed state model, a model in which you have many thermodynamic states that themselves are decompositions of infinitely many pure states. You know, what do the thermodynamic identities say about those? And what we found, and we published in PhysRev Letters back in 2016 or so, was that the only mixed state model that satisfies these thermodynamic identities is the replica symmetry breaking picture. So what we have, what we, you know, so, you know, obviously as you go along, you know, you hone your thinking and, you know, and new things become apparent. What we can say now, I think with some degree of certainty, is that if there are many thermodynamic states, and if those thermodynamic states are mixed states or mixtures of many pure states, then it must be the replica symmetry breaking picture, that there are no alternative pictures of that. And I think that's a strong argument in support of replica symmetry breaking. With that being said, however, we, you know, and we also mentioned this chaotic pairs picture, which came out of the metastate. It's not a picture that we advocate as being correct. It simply is, you know, a picture that, you know, is a viable alternative many state picture. But there, the thermodynamic states are not non-trivial mixtures of infinitely many pure states. They're just mixtures of a single pair. So there's uncountably many, you know, pure states, but are organized in a very different way. So what we've tried to do is to really narrow down all of the possibilities. And at this point, you know, I think we've, you know, we wrote a paper just recently that's still under review at PhysRev, you know, in which we say, you know, basically here are the four basic pictures and they can be related to each other in certain ways. And we found ways to relate all of them. They're replica symmetry breaking, chaotic pairs, the TNT picture and droplet scaling. You know, if we were forced to choose a picture at this point, it seems to me that droplet scaling still seems to me like, you know, the most plausible alternative. But the question is completely open. And mostly, I just would like to know what the answer is. I don't have a particular, you know, horse in the race as far as this is concerned. I would just like to know what spin glasses really do look like below PC.
And the answer may well depend upon the spatial dimension.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are plenty of people. Mike Moore is a primary advocate of this, that above six dimensions, you have replica symmetry breaking. Below six dimensions, you have maybe droplet scaling. You know, now the droplet scaling people, or at least in their early papers, would say that replica symmetry breaking doesn't hold in any finite dimension. That may be true. I mean, I still think that there's a reasonable chance that that is true. But, you know, I mean, it's the kind of thing where is if, you know, if somebody forced me to bet, I'd probably bet on scaling droplet, but I would prefer not to bet at all because spin glasses are very tricky things. We have learned quite a lot over the years. And we, you know, at least at this point, we can sort of say, we're pretty sure now it has to be, you know, we've sort of narrowed down. Our rigorous work has done a lot, I think, to narrow down many, many possibilities into just a small handful now. And I'm actually, you know, and I feel that, you know, even though I know that we have a reputation as people who are somehow anti-RSB, you know, I think we've actually tried to do a lot for RSB as well. You know, I mean, we've sort of tried to say, this is how RSB must look in short range spin glasses. And then in that more recent paper, we went further and said that, you know, if you do have this complicated structure of many thermodynamic states, each of which is composed of a convex combination of infinitely many pure states, then it must be the replica symmetry breaking picture. So Chuck, do you wanna add anything to that?
I mean, before we keep on in this line of thought, I wanted to ask a specific historical question, right? In 1998, you presented this particular problem, the problem of finite range spin glasses, as one of the key open problems in mathematical physics for Michael Eisenman's list, who was being established at the time. Why, in your mind, is this problem important for mathematical physics? And should it belong to that list?
I'll wait for Chuck. I have my own thoughts, but I'll wait for. I'll let Chuck take this first, and then I'll add my.
Well, I would say that it it simultaneously has the two features of an important problem in mathematical physics should have. One is that it's important from the physics point of view, what the answer is. And second, doing things mathematically rigorous seems to be not only useful in this situation, but maybe even necessary to answer the question. So if you combine those two things, that somehow puts it on this short list of significant problems.
So
Can I add? Yes. Yeah, so I'll add two things to that. One is that first, replica symmetry breaking is a very beautiful mathematical solution. I gave a talk at the Santa Fe Institute on the Parisi solution of the Nobel Prize last week, and it's on the Santa Fe Institute YouTube channel if you want to check that out. But it's extremely important to see if such a beautiful theory, which it is, really does apply to short range spin glasses in any dimension. I mean, whether it goes down as far as three is debatable, but that would be extremely important because we really have not seen anything like that in any other statistical mechanics problem. So we certainly would want to know whether it does apply to finite dimensional spin glasses. And if it doesn't, then you have something that is really peculiar. I mean, we know that there's an upper critical dimension for mean field theories to be valid, but what people are talking about that is behavior near TC, near the transition temperature, where fluctuations become important. But nobody's ever disputed that mean field theory doesn't work well at low temperatures in terms of figuring out the order parameter. After Ginzburg-Landau theory, mean field theory figured out the order parameter for superconductors, long before BCS came along. So the thing is that if the mean field theory doesn't get the low temperature ordering correct, that means that this would also be something different from anything that we've ever seen before. And that the dimension goes to infinity limit would somehow be singular in the behavior. And that's quite, and there are reasons to think that that may be the case, which we mentioned in our book. But the other thing that I think makes this so important is that, since the 1930s, when, people were able to come up with theories of the solid state and of ferromagnetism, and then, we came along broken symmetry, and we have this nice picture of the condensed state in homogeneous systems and crystals and ferromagnets and superconductors and superfluids, liquid crystals, and so on. But a lot of matter is not ordered or crystalline. We have glasses and spin glasses and all the rest. And so there's this big gap still in our understanding of the condensed matter state. And it seems to me that until we are able to solve this problem, which by the way, Phil Anderson once called the most important problem in condensed matter physics. He said that before high temperature superconductors came along, but in the early 80s. If we don't solve that problem, then I think we have a huge gap in our understanding of the condensed matter state, which, I think that is something that needs to be addressed. So it is an extremely important problem.
So in the mid 2000s, so 2003, 2004, 2005, the formal proofs to the full RSB picture in infinite dimensions start to emerge. And up until that point, I guess some could argue that this was still a hypothesis and not rigorous, but were you surprised by that result? Or, now you speak at it retroactively, being convinced that infinite dimension has to be the case, but were you convinced that it actually was the correct picture and goes to infinity?
You mean in infinite dimensions? Yeah. No, we never doubted for a second that the Parisi solution was correct for the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. There's not a single one of our papers in which we ever said anything remotely like that. No, our all of our discussions about RSB maybe not applying had to do with whether they applied to the Edwards-Anderson model in finite dimensions. But we, in fact, we were glad to see Guerra's papers and Tolleground's papers and so on, and Toninelli and all these other people who worked on these problems. But we never doubted for a second that the Parisi solution was correct. The second it came out, it was clear to us I was clear to, I mean, we weren't together then. It was clear to me as soon as the Parisi solution came out that that was the answer. And I'm sure Chuck probably felt the same way.
Well, yeah, I guess as soon as I learned, as soon as I learned about it, which was somewhat later, I didn't have any arguments with it. I mean, I understood that it was, you know, interesting and quite non-trivial to actually prove that it worked, but there was no particular reason to doubt it.
Right, right.
So in 2013, you published a book for the educated public, right? A long Scientific American-like article. Why did you think that such a book was then warranted? And what led to it?
Yeah, well, what happened was that it was back to the summer school and complex systems was the origin of that book. Back in, I don't remember, 2011, 2012, something like that, maybe even roughly around then, I guess I gave a series of lectures at the Santa Fe Institute Summer School. At that point, Daniel Rockmore was the director. He asked me to give some talks. So I gave a week-long series of talks on the spin glass. And when it was over, Dan Rockmore came to me and said, I think he was an editor along with John Miller of a series published by Princeton University Press called Primers in Complexity. And, you know, would I be interested in converting those lectures into a volume? And I said, well, you know, everything that I've done on spin glasses, at least that's been any good, has been, well, I shouldn't say that because the 83 paper with Gabi, but almost everything that I've done on spin glasses has been with Chuck, and, you know, we would have wanted to do that together. So I had to first to see if Chuck was interested, and Chuck said that he was. And so, you know, the two of us together sat down and we wrote this book. And, you know, we tried to be fair in the book to all sides, and, you know, and it was fun to sit down and sort of think about these things and how to explain it to the general public, because these are not easy topics to explain.
Yeah, and I guess there's a chance we might do a revised version, is it?
Well, a second edition, possibly. Yeah, Princeton has been in touch with us about possibly doing a second edition, and, you know, we'll see. It depends on how much energy we have left at this point.
And we have a silly kind of notion that maybe someday it will be turned into a film. So maybe you find some avant-garde French director who...
movie rights, thanks to Chuck.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have to take too much from the book itself. Just use the title is fine, and a little bit from the book.
So you've both held administrative positions throughout your careers. Did you ever use your leadership position to recruit or to otherwise value spinning glass related work or researchers?
Never for me. I was a department head and of physics, and then later dean of science, and I had to look at the interests and needs of the department as a whole. So no, I never.
Well, I used that role a little bit to help recruit Dan to come to the NYU from Arizona.
Oh, there's that. Yes, yes.
So there was that one instance.
Yes. Okay, that instance, yes. Right.
But nowhere beyond, there's the cornucopia, right? As you mentioned, there's all these other fields. It's not necessarily just spinning glasses, but that never came up, or you never had the chance to weigh in the scale.
The thing is that what was needed when I was head of the physics department of the University of Arizona, we needed to build up in all kinds of different areas. What I mostly focused on in the early days was building up in soft condensed matter physics and biological physics and things like that. But there were a bunch of other areas as well. And, you know, when I was dean at NYU, I had all of the science departments that I had to worry about. And, at that point, it really, I think most of the recruiting for things in probability theory and statistical mechanics was really done at Courant, which was not under my purview as dean of science. That's its own separate institute. But Courant, I felt, had we didn't need to recruit in that area in the physics department because there was so much need to, you know, spread out in all kinds of other areas. But, you know, as Chuck pointed out, I suppose I myself, though, am a personal example of this kind of thing, since Chuck did play a very major role, not just in recruiting me to NYU, but in convincing me to come to NYU.
Yeah, so something not a little bit farther afield that I did play some role in was something which has been a significant change within the world of mathematics over my career, which is how probability theory is regarded. When I was, early in my career, and hearing stories from people who were older than me, like Moni Dansker, probability was barely considered part of mathematics. If you go back 40 or 50 years, you know, it had a funny origins in gambling and things of that sort. And there were some very good people, and there were some places that, you know, specialized, but in general, it was somehow regarded as a funny field. I've been told that in France, for example, you know, if you weren't in algebraic geometry, you were regarded as, you know, someone not doing anything of interest. And that has completely changed. I mean, the probability is now somehow one of the most fashionable areas of mathematics, including its probability in the kind of statistical physics context. Yeah. So that, you know, I'm certainly not responsible for that, but whenever I had a chance, I helped move that along.
How's algebraic geometry doing these days?
It's holding its own, but it's, you know, no longer the only game in the field.
Not the only game in town.
Do you have any insight into how spin glass and spin glass related questions were became less important in the United States than it is in Europe, in the physics community and beyond? Not so in probability, actually. So in the mathematical departments, that's not so true, but definitely in the physics department.
Yeah, so I think Dan is better equipped to answer that.
Yeah, so in the early 80s, of course, there were lots of work on spin glasses. You notice, though, that almost immediately, much of the work started getting diverted from spin glasses proper to applications of spin glasses to problems in biology and computer science and so on. Then at some point in the mid 1980s, I mean, I don't remember the timeline exactly, but the bottom sort of dropped out of the market. The NSF is sort of getting harder and harder to get grants. In fact, you know, Chuck and I had joint grant for many years from NSF, but it was really from the Division of Mathematical Sciences, not from the physics part. And I think we were one of the very, very, very few people who had grants at all in spin glasses. Fashions change, things move along. You know, there was a lot of ferment and activity from 1975 to 1985 in spin glasses. And then once the mean field problem had been solved, a lot of people moved on to other things. And then, of course, in 1986, Bednors and Willard discovered high temperature superconductivity, and there was a massive shift of condensed matter theorists to that field. And, you know, that and all kinds of, you know, correlated electrons became a synonym almost for condensed matter physics. And, I sort of felt like, you know, there's this big problem out there that has not been solved yet, you know, that of the short range spin glass. We know the mean field solution, but we still don't know the solution for the short range spin glass. Is it the mean field solution? Is it scaling droplet? Is it something else? And, so we've just sort of doggedly persisted in, you know, pursuing this problem, and despite the fact that, it might have been better, for our careers, I suppose, if we had just, done other things. But, this was a problem that really, really, I think, grabbed our interest, and that we really did care about trying to understand and to find the solutions. And so here we are.
So at Princeton, at Arizona, NYU, did you ever teach a class about spin glasses or replica symmetry breaking? If yes, can you detail?
So I've done it. I've done it at the summer school. You know, as you know, the first summer school I spoke about, you know, spin glasses and replica symmetry breaking, and I've given lectures on it. I gave another set of lectures at another summer school. I don't recall giving a course on spin glass.
I know it's part of a statistical physics graduate course, say.
Yeah, no, I've given courses in statistical physics, but not like a specialty topics course in spin glasses or disordered systems in particular. Chuck, you must have given a series of lectures though when you were in Europe, because your book Topics in Disordered Systems, I think, arose out of that, didn't it?
Yes. The book Topics in Disordered Systems, which is more general than spin glasses, but I guess includes that. That was a book that came out of a kind of special topics course when I was a visitor at ETH in Zurich. So I guess that's probably. But I think this spin glasses, you know, played a, you know, was a part of that, not maybe the major part, but that may be the only.
The only instance,
yes, of that sort. I don't remember, certainly not at Arizona, and I don't remember. I've given special topics courses, but they've been on other aspects of statistical physics, like usually percolation or ferromagnets or Liang theorems or things of that sort, not really spin glasses.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with us about this era that we may have missed or skipped over inadvertently?
Patrick, are you talking about the year from 1975 to 85?
Or loosely, no, from 19 to 95 and loosely, you know, the scope of what we've talked about.
Well, I mean, I was very, you know, I was extremely gratified and happy to see that the Nobel Prize was given to Parisi. You know, I think that it's about time that spin glasses were recognized as an important problem. And I think this would be very good for the field. So I'm quite pleased about that. And, you know, I hope it leads to a resurgence of interest in the field. And Chuck and I guess we sent a congratulatory email to Giorgio. And
like many thousands of us, yes.
Like many thousands of others, right.
Yes, maybe sometime we'll go back and dig up some of the emails. There were a few emails we had with him back 20 years ago or so, which might be of historical interest to look at.
Actually, speaking of which, do you still have notes, papers, correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
These are correspondences that go back to the 90s. I can look.
And before, I mean this also for your work from the 80s as well.
Oh yeah, of course that was before email was even common. I mean, I have, I don't know, tons and tons of unorganized, unsorted out, loose papers of all kinds of things. But in terms of, Chuck and I, of course, have a very long correspondence, email correspondence, and we do have some correspondence with Parisi in the very early days. We could try to dig those up if you're interested. We must have them somewhere. I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's even a chance we could find them. We could find them, take a look at them, and if they're not too embarrassing to us.
I sort of remember them, pretty well. They're not embarrassing to either party. They were collegial, cordial, you know, back and forth.
There was something like, here's the reason you're wrong.
The thing is that, but then he presented a you know, an argument as to why what you should do should be a single delta function. But we also had I remember, you know, we actually had a pretty good back and forth I think would be rather interesting, and that I'm certainly not embarrassed about. And we'd be, if I can find them, I'll be happy to send them to you.
Thank you both very much for your time for this discussion.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for, I mean, you obviously prepared for this very
conscientiously. You know more about what we did than we remember.
Quite impressive.
Patrick, are you involved?